From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. As President Trump tours the border today, the government shutdown grinds on. Day 20, no end in sight. The president is talking more about declaring a national emergency to go around Congress and use already appropriated funds to build the wall. We've been hearing from members of Congress from both parties, and joining us now is Republican Congressman Kelly Armstrong of North Dakota. Congressman, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And what do you think about the idea, which looks like it's more likely, of the president circumventing Congress and you to get his wall and saying there's an emergency and I've got to just do it myself?
Yeah, I mean, I always hesitate. I think one thing that we need to always do up here, and I support this president a lot. He's been great to our state. But I get a little concerned when we start abdicating Congress's responsibility on a lot of things. That being said, the lowest number in the last 20 years that I've had of illegal border crossings on the southern border is 400,000 people. So, well, the issue has risen to the top. I think it's been coming and percolating for a long time.
You seem like you're making the case that it is a national emergency and that he would be able to do this and it wouldn't be stopped in the courts.
Yeah, well, I'm an old trial lawyer, so you'll never get from me it won't be stopped in the courts, will or won't be granted or denied in the courts until actually a judge has signed off of it. But I do think it is at a crisis point, and I think it's been building to a crisis point for a very long time.
Now, the president tweeted today that there is great unity among Republicans in the House and Senate. But last night, 8 House Republicans broke ranks, passed a bill with Democrats to reopen some parts of the government, the Treasury Department, without funding the wall. That is one more Republican, 8, than supported a similar bill last week. Are we starting to see cracks in the Republican Party?
Oh, I mean, each district has their own issues to deal with, but I think, I mean, when you're dealing with these issues, you're always going to have numbers like that. I don't think 8 is a serious number on the House side at this point, no.
Now, tomorrow, hundreds of thousands of federal workers are going to miss their first paycheck. There are other things not happening. The Food and Drug Administration has stopped routine food safety inspections. The FAA has stopped inspecting all planes at airports, although airlines are still doing some of their own inspections. Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, say they downgraded their estimate of economic growth by 0.1% because of the shutdown. Do you think this is all worth it for just $5 billion for a wall?
Well, I think it's a lot more than just $5 billion for the wall. I think if we don't have a real negotiation from both sides and leaders of both parties right now, that's something that can get that will pass the House, will get taken to the floor at the Senate, and will get signed by the president. I don't think it comes again. I don't buy the argument that we can open the government and then have a real conversation about that. And I think we saw some of that yesterday. So yes, I mean, even in North Dakota, where you can't get a lot farther away than the southern border than North Dakota. During our campaign and as we were out across the state, border security and immigration were huge issues, even in the state of North Dakota.
But are they as huge issues as making sure that the salad that you're buying at the supermarket is safe?
Well, there's bigger issues. As if you're not going to deal with this issue now, we've proven in a bipartisan fashion that we are really good at kicking this issue down the road for, I would say, going on over 20 years at this point. And I think it's time to address the issue.
So you're saying it is worth it?
At this point, yes. I mean, the longer they go, and those metrics can change the longer we go into this. But yes, we need to secure our border.
And how do you feel about what happened yesterday? The president getting up and walking out of a meeting. Is that a good way to negotiate, in your view?
Well, I think when the answer on the other side is, if we do this right now, are we going to have a border wall? And the answer is no. I think we get a pretty good idea of where everybody is at. This president's made concessions for him. I mean, moving from a concrete wall to steel was a big deal. And it appears to me, at least from the Democratic leadership side, the negotiation is just, no, you're not going to get it under any circumstances. So when you get into those negotiations, a lot of times it's not a terrible idea to walk away and come back later.
Do you think that things will change dramatically tomorrow when the first pay period happens?
Again, that deals a lot with each particular member has to deal with the pressure points in their own district. And so we'll see how it continues to move forward.
That is Republican Congressman Kelly Armstrong of North Dakota. Congressman, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So to those 800,000 federal employees shut down, as Jeremy said, some working, they won't get a paycheck tomorrow. They should get it when the shutdown ends. Some furloughed, not working, and that pay will never be made up unless Congress passes legislation after the government reopens. They're all getting advice from the Office of Personnel Management, OPM. Crystal Kirkpatrick was furloughed, sent home from her job at the IRS 20 days ago. She joins us now from her home in Ogden, Utah. So Crystal, again, you're furloughed. Furloughed, not working.
Right now, we're not working and not being paid at all.
Yeah. So you know, when this is all over, unlike people who are working and not being paid, you won't be getting this money back.
Correct. Yes. Unless that back pay bill passes unanimously, then we're not going to receive any funds.
Okay. And look, you've got two kids, a 12-year-old Taylor, a 6-year-old Preston. Your husband still has his job as a machine operator for Westinghouse. Is his paycheck enough to get by on?
You know, I've done some crunching, and it's just not going to cut it to get by on. Hmm. We've got, you know, mortgages, car payments. My husband has an autoimmune disease. We can't just not fill medications. Hmm. And he's been working overtime to make up for the money that we're missing. And I just don't see how we could make it work. We've got some money in savings, but that's not going to last forever.
Okay, so you mentioned mortgage and car payments right there. That's a chunk. Will you be able to do that? We understand that all the furloughed and working without pay federal workers, 800,000, together owe over $400 million in mortgage and rent just this coming month alone. Will you make it?
I did contact my mortgage company, and I asked them if they would be able to work with me as far as paying once I got paid. And I said, I've got this letter from the IRS. I'm affected by the government shutdown. Can you work with me? And they simply said that a skip payment or a late payment is without any penalty or dinged to my credit is not something they do. They were not willing to work with me.
Well, you know, and President Trump has been saying, ask your mortgage company, ask your landlord.
He has, and I did, because I wanted to know if they were going to work with me. And, you know, if I paid it late, I was going to pay a penalty that would make my mortgage payment even larger.
Yeah.
And then I was going to have a ding to my credit. And we aren't the kind of people that pay our bills late. So that really would truly hurt my heart.
So you're finding that the mortgage companies are not going to bend the rules for you, which a lot of people are saying, why would they? I mean, if they said yes to you, the mortgage companies would have to say yes to everyone. What has the IRS told you about how to deal with the shutdown? We're hearing people in the Coast Guard were told to hold garage sales and get babysitting jobs. Were you told anything?
We've heard those. We heard the mortgage, you know, see if you can barter carpentry work or painting. And that's just not something your mortgage company is willing to do. So we did have to dip into our savings to cover our mortgage payment.
Wait, I have to. The IRS told you to try to bargain some kind of other work for your payments, like carpentry work?
Yeah. On those, the OPM has issued some letters, and in those letters, it says, you know, can I barter, like, to compromise on my rent or to get a discount on my rent? Can I paint? Something of that nature to help lower my rent?
These are the questions they're telling you to ask if you're a renter. As you're well aware, you work for the IRS, and that's a particularly disliked federal agency. You know, there are people who are saying, well, there's too many government workers anyway. Government workers are overpaid or are lazy. You know, the people who think that the government is too bloated, you know what they say. What would you say to them about the work that you provide? How do you feel about being in the middle of this political football? You are the political football.
Yeah, we feel like pawns in a fight that we didn't start and we have no control over. But the job we do is important and we take pride in it. Everyone at the Ogden location, we work hard. I think the job I do is important, and I know that while I'm sitting at home, my workload is not taking a break. It is just piling up. And those are all those taxpayers that need my help. And I need to be there to help them.
Look, Crystal, can you handle a little levity at this moment? I know it's a very serious moment, but do you mind if we just take a second to listen to something?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, Jimmy Kimmel has pledged to hire federal workers until the shutdown is over. And one of them, for instance, is a fellow named John Kastelnik. He's a prison guard at the Federal Correctional Complex in California. And here's the exchange Kimmel had with him.
Do you play an instrument, a musical instrument of any kind?
No, I don't.
You do not. Okay. Do we have a tambourine, though, right? Okay. You can play the tambourine, right?
Sure.
All right, John, you're in the band.
Thank you so much.
Crystal, so I know this is, again, it's a very serious thing you're going through, but thoughts?
I commented under his post that I will volunteer as tribute. Does he need a crafting assistant? I'm really good at that.
Well, from your lips to Jimmy Kimmel's ears. Crystal Kirkpatrick, furloughed from her job at the IRS, speaking to us from Ogden, Utah. Crystal, thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
And by the way, there is a possibility of a callback of IRS workers to get tax returns out on time. In Crystal's job, she helps businesses with their returns. She told us she hopes she gets called because, she said, people will need her. Queens are hot. The new season of Victoria starts Sunday on PBS. Do not call me. Mary, Queen of Scots is still in theaters. The Crown returns soon on Netflix with actress Olivia Colman replacing Claire Foy as Queen Elizabeth, which we're sure will be nothing like Olivia Colman's Queen Anne in the current sizzling hot film The Favorite. And The Favorite is unlike any Queen film you've ever seen. It's early 1700s England. Queen Anne, hobbled by illness and grief after 17 failed pregnancies, each represented with a pet rabbit. Her close friend and lover, Lady Sarah Churchill, played by Rachel Weisz, is actually running the country. Enter Sarah's cousin Abigail, played by Emma Stone, reduced to being a chambermaid because of a family bankruptcy. In this scene, the new triangle plays out as Emma Stone's maid tries to serve hot chocolate to Coleman's queen when Weisz's Lady Sarah interrupts.
None for the queen. What? Well, you cannot have hot chocolate. Your stomach, the sugar inflames it.
Abigail, hand me that cup.
Do not.
I'm sorry. I do not know what to do.
Oh, fine. Give it to her. And then you can get a bucket and a mop for the aftermath.
Did we mention there's a lot of throwing up in The Favorite and wild dancing, and we watch as Abigail murderously social climbs right into the Queen's bed. No, this is not your mother's Masterpiece Theater. It is a disturbing, funny, touching look at women in power and love. On most U.S. best of lists, it also dominated Britain's BAFTA nominations yesterday with 12. Joining us, the man who put it all together, director Yorgos Lanthimos. Welcome.
Hi.
And Lady Sarah, I mean Rachel Weisz, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Rachel, what a character. What a meaty, juicy character at times, especially when she had a writing crop, a frightening character. How did you feel about embodying her?
Well, it was wonderful to have such an incredible piece of writing, as all the three female characters are. She's not just one thing. She's not just a powerful, in-charge woman. She's fragile, vulnerable, ridiculous, absurd, in love. I mean, she's many, many, many things. So I think that was what all three of us enjoyed about right. Our parts.
And Yorgos, original screenplay by Deborah Davis and then Tony McNamara. You worked on it as well. In the historical account, Anne the Queen is quite frail, quite erratic. What appealed to you about that, first of all, that woman and this time in history?
It wasn't necessarily the time. It was the fact that this real story existed, to discover that these three women at some point in time had such power, that their personal relationships, their character, their behavior, their moods could affect the lives of millions of other people. So I just felt that it was rich in every way, both yeah. for the characters and the story and how they are connected to the rest of the world.
And onto this historical scaffolding, I mean, it really is true that Anne had this best friend from childhood, Lady Sarah Churchill. There were rumors that were talked about in the tabloids of the day that they were lovers. There really was a cousin of Sarah's, Abigail, who came in. Let's listen to another scene. And this is one in which you really can see early on Sarah's control of the Queen, her domination. The Queen enters a room to take a meeting with the Russian ambassador. Let's listen.
I'm ready for the Russian ambassador.
Who did your makeup?
We went for something dramatic. Do you like it?
You look like a badger.
Oh. Are you going to cry? Really?
Well, what do you think you look like? Badger. Do you really think you can meet the Russian delegation looking like that?
No. I will manage it. Go back to your rooms.
Rachel, take a second and talk about working with the incredible Olivia Colman.
She really is an incredible actress. To play opposite her is just an honor, a privilege, and joyful. I think she has just a lot less skin than other people.
What do you mean?
Well, her emotions are very immediate. They're very unmediated and unfiltered. They just come straight to the surface. And she can walk a line between tragedy and comedy. Even in that scene, I think, she makes you cry from her vulnerability, but it's extremely funny. And so that mixture of groundedness and truthfulness whilst being hilarious, it's an incredible cocktail.
It's fabulous. And she really did kind of look like a badger. And Yorgos, talk about the look of the film, the men in the huge wigs and the powdered faces. It was more Versailles, you know, than Britain. And there's an incredible dance scene, which was right out of, you know, Madonna's Vogue video. You layered on this historical scaffolding, this phantasmagoria. What was that? What were you doing there?
I think in general, in many parts of the process of making this film, what we try to do is layer it with various contemporary textures. We knew early on that we wanted to use contemporary dialogue and not necessarily try and imitate the way we think people spoke at the time. And that, you know, continue later down the line when we were thinking about the visuals of the film. The costumes, for instance, are loyal to the shape of the period, but we used a lot of contemporary materials like leather and vintage denim and plastic and 3D printed accessories that add this contemporary feel to the film and makes it feel more relevant.
Did you look at other period pieces, or did you just know this is not going to be in that genre?
We looked at various different things. We looked at period pieces that did things differently that were inspiring, like Peter Greenaway's Draftsman's Contract to Amadeus, Bergman's Cries and Whispers. But it was, I think from the beginning, it was for me the challenge and the reason I was intrigued to make this film as well, apart from the very strong story and characters, was to try and make something fresh and different and original.
Well, you succeeded. It's more like Survivor, or, you know, or How to Survive the Castle. Let's listen to another scene where we see some of that. At this point, we know that Sarah, Rachel, your character, and the Queen are lovers, and Abigail seems to be coming in on that relationship, and Sarah has taken Abigail the maid out to go shooting, and she shoots a gun right at Abigail and then calmly goes on. Let's listen.
Abigail. If you forget to load the pellet, the gun fires, makes a sound, but releases no shot. It is a great jape. Do you agree?
Yes.
Maybe we will think of a use for it one day. Sometimes it is hard to remember whether you have loaded the pellet or not. I do fear confusion and accidents.
Talk about a warning shot.
People, because
you know, firing a warning shot. Rachel, I mean, that must have been just juicy to sink your teeth into that part of it, this sort of, you know, as people are saying, it's given new meaning to the phrase palace intrigue.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a game of life and death, but everyone's speaking in this kind of light, this light way. But the stakes are very, very high. I mean, the two women in the scene that you just played, one is running England and one is trying to usurp her. So it's it's high stakes.
It is. Did you ever worry, either of you, about it just devolving, and it didn't, into a catfight, claws out?
I mean, I think that that's often what fiction does with women in power struggles. I mean, men in power struggles would never, in a fictional version, would never, I don't know what the equivalent of a male catfight is, but, you know, this is...
That's telling that we don't know.
Right, because
don't
it's
fight,
called it's called life. It's called power.
It's called life.
Yeah.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So these are complicated human beings struggling for power who happen to be women, rather than the cliche of women clawing each other's eyes out. I knew from the script that that wouldn't be the case. And yeah. I certainly know from Yorgos that he wouldn't have the chicks in a cat fight.
And Yorgos, just a little more about that dance scene. Where did that spring from?
Well, we worked with a great choreographer whose work I liked, Constanza Macras. And I knew that I wanted to do something different with the physicality of this film. Again, I didn't want to have people walking, sitting, standing, dancing the way that we think people did at the time. So I looked for a choreographer that would help me do that. And we worked with Constanza, came up with things and fooled around, and we tried things and changed things, even in the last minute because of costumes and various other complications. But yeah, I think it was fun in the end. No, Rachel?
It was exhilarating. I've certainly never danced professionally before. Yes, and the fact that the whole complicated, joyous, absurd dance is happening, the drama of the scene is on the close-up of Olivia Colman's face, the queen watching, because she's got gout and she's in a wheelchair and she can't dance. So you see her envy of my character's ability to fly around the dance floor like that, and her anger, and it becomes an incredibly emotional scene from watching Olivia's face. Again, a moment where she's incredibly moving, but it's also very funny because she's just quite ridiculous at the same time.
Well, and that dance scene becomes microcosm of the whole film, that, you know, at the end, yeah, it's been ridiculous and absurd. And by the way, Abigail didn't really poison your character, Sarah, but and the queen really didn't have rabbits to replace her children. But there's enough of real heartbreak at the end. There was a power struggle, but there was love.
Yeah, it is a love story.
Yeah, after all.
Yeah.
We're talking about the film The Favorite. It's many critics' favorites. Its star, Rachel Weisz, and director, Yorgos Lanthimos. Thank you for such a beautiful film.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
President Trump is in South Texas today to pay a visit to the U.S.-Mexico border. He's promoting his proposed wall and calling for more troops to be deployed in the region. The president is visiting an area that active duty service members left just a few weeks ago, and local residents are split on whether that first deployment made any difference. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame reports.
Cars rush past Hollywood Drive-Thru, a convenience store in Weslaco, Texas, about 10 miles north of the border. Inside, Emily Rosales rings up customers. In November, Rosales began seeing some new faces at her drive-thru, Army troops who had been deployed to the border. They took over an old furniture store down the road and used it as a sleeping area for about 200 soldiers and began accumulating equipment in an adjacent lot.
Each week as it went by, they're adding stuff to it, adding spotlights, barbed wire, tanker trucks. At first, it was kind of, wow, like, this is going on here. This is a big thing.
For several weeks, the Weslaco area was a hub for the Trump administration's border hardening operation. Active duty soldiers installed concertina wire around U.S. ports of entry and helped the Border Patrol with transportation and medical support. But in December, they mostly cleared out of the Rio Grande Valley.
There was business for a while until they left.
Christina Garfield, a Republican Party leader from McAllen, Texas, says she didn't think her town warranted military attention, at least at first.
But then I learned that our area is one of the main entry points for the majority of illegal immigrants.
She says she thinks the mission was successful, in part because she's seen no migrant caravans cross the border.
I think it was smart. I think it was a tactical move that worked as a deterrent because they did not come. Those thousands of people that were supposedly coming didn't end up coming.
But Jim Darling, the Democratic mayor of McAllen, disagrees. He says there is a problem at the border with asylum seekers overwhelming the system, but he doesn't think the military deployment helped.
I think it's another example of a failed border and immigration policy. It's an example of misunderstanding of the dynamics of the border. Short-term solutions don't work.
And Darling says the troops left behind a problem, the concertina wire at port of entry bridges, some of which fall under his city's jurisdiction.
The Army didn't ask for any permission or give us any notice. They went in and decided where they needed to do that. We've taken some of it down because we didn't think it's appropriate, especially around our office buildings, etc. Thought it was more dangerous than preventive.
Citing environmental and safety concerns, he says more wire may yet come down. Local officials will meet to talk about it soon. While this isn't the first time the military has patrolled the border, the mission takes them out of their customary role of fighting foreign enemies. And Princeton history professor Julian Zelizer says it may change the public's perception of the armed forces.
Is this really just about politics, or is there something genuine? And the more the public thinks it's manufactured, the next time force is used or deployed, and it might be a very legitimate reason, you're going to have more skeptics about why it's all happening.
A smaller number of troops remain on duty at the border, and the Trump administration now is planning a second deployment of thousands of military personnel from California to Texas. For Here and Now, I'm Carson Frame.
And Carson's story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans.
Are decades-old civil rights protections affecting education, housing, banking, and more in jeopardy? Well, according to new reporting in The Washington Post, yes, they are. The Trump administration is considering rolling back the disparate impact rules. They essentially prevent policies from being enacted if they present an undue or disparate burden on minority communities. Sources told the paper that an internal Justice Department memo has asked senior civil rights officials to examine how these regulations might be changed or altogether abolished in their areas of expertise, and that this rollback is being considered at other agencies as well, sounding alarms for civil rights activists and lawyers. Among them, Christine Clark, President and Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. President Clark, Christine, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Go deeper into what we mean by disparate impact rules. Lay some out for us that we can grasp.
So there are essentially two ways that civil rights lawyers go about establishing whether or not something has a discriminatory effect or impact. First, we can look to see if there's evidence of animus, discriminatory intent, evidence that officials were motivated by ugly, venomous racial animus when putting in place some policy or practice.
Those are the easy ones to see.
Yes, right. And the reality is we live in a world today where we are often without that smoking gun evidence of intent. So disparate impact has proven to be a critical tool for smoking out policies and practices that burden communities of color more than others. And we do that really by digging into the data and overlaying it with race to understand the impact that a policy has in the world. And whether you're talking about policies in the housing context, voting rights context, education, or elsewhere, disparate impact is just central for understanding why it is that some policies harm minority communities more than others.
It might be something that's called implicit bias. You know, people may not realize they're doing it. For instance, all the research that showed that minority students are far more punished for the same offenses that white students are not as harshly punished for. That is a disparate impact.
That's right. In the school-to-prison pipeline context, when we dig into the data, we see a lot of school districts where Black and Latino students are punished far more harshly for the same conduct relative to their white peers. Without the ability to look at disparate impact, we'd live in a world where there'd be a lot more rampant discrimination today.
How might you see it in housing?
Well, this is where the administration has focused its efforts. They're attempting to roll back HUD's disparate impact regulation. We live in a world, sadly, where communities remain racially segregated and where we see a lot of ugly housing discrimination. And HUD has been critical in the fight to push back against the policies of housing providers, landlords, and others that continue to discriminate against minority communities and disparate impact, understanding the zoning restrictions and other policies that landlords put in place and how they impact communities has just been at the heart of how HUD has approached this work. And so here the administration is really sending a dangerous message that unless there's smoking gun evidence of intent, they're not going to roll up their sleeves and do work to promote fair housing. And that is unfortunate.
In New York, the Washington Post is reporting there's a lawsuit right now alleging that a large apartment complex in Queens won't rent to anyone with a criminal record. That turns out to be largely disproportionately African-American and Latino renters in that neighborhood. And so there's a suit pending, and it is relying on this disparate impact claim to make its case.
That's right. And look, sometimes officials are unaware of the implicit bias that they harbor, or on the other side, are just sophisticated in the ways in which they try to discriminate against communities. Regardless of what may be brewing in someone's mind or heart, disparate impact has allowed us to really just get to the core of what's at play.
Can you give us more examples?
Well, let's talk about the foreclosure crisis that gripped the nation, largely the result of banks imposing pernicious policies and peddling bad loan products to African Americans, Latinos, and other communities of color. The Equal Credit Opportunity Act is a federal law that basically gives us a tool. Disparate impact liability is imposed on banks that engage in discriminatory lending. So whether you're talking about housing, voting, education.
The environment. Give an example there.
Yeah. Let's talk about businesses that emit dangerous toxins in and near minority communities. It's important that we understand how businesses operate in this era. And one thing that we found in the environmental justice context is that too often dangerous toxins are unleashed into communities of color.
We only know from the Washington Post reporting that they're considering removing the language about disparate impact. That's all that we know. But if, in fact, it was removed, can they do that, remove that language from a regulation without Congress, for instance?
Well, they are seeking public comment, and there are rules that the administration needs to abide by before rolling back these regulations that are put into place after a lot of careful thought and consideration. We're going to be watching HUD very carefully. We've actually brought a number of lawsuits against the administration when they've tried to gut important regulations without taking the necessary precursor steps.
And what about laws like the Civil Rights Act, 1964, Voting Rights Act, disparate impact, part of those as well? Can they be removed from those laws?
Well, we know that disparate impact is already built into the text of a number of our core civil rights laws, like the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act has a provision that makes it illegal for jurisdictions to impose rules and restrictions that harm minority voters. And we've used Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act to challenge things, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, like voter ID. But what the administration is doing is it's broadcasting really dangerous message about its views on disparate impact, that it does not deem disparate impact to be a viable or acceptable approach for dealing with discrimination. And so we know that there are some battles that lie ahead.
As the Washington Post notes, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, under Ben Carson, has already stepped back from investigating housing discrimination cases. The Trump administration has already tried to roll back transgender rights in housing and in the military. Playing devil's advocate, I'm sure there are people who find this an extra layer of regulation that's not needed, and it's just another layer of government.
Well, I think that we will see the resurgence of discrimination. The administration is basically sending a green light that there is this whole approach to ferreting out discrimination that they no longer will be abiding by. The reality is that this latest move by the administration is part of an ongoing pattern of dismantling civil rights protections for African Americans and other people of color. And so this development is significant and one that everyone should pay close attention to.
Well, and does it extend beyond that to the disabled, the elderly, groups that have needed protection?
At every turn, we have seen this administration turning its back on vulnerable communities in our country and gutting the work of federal agencies that have long been tasked with enforcing law and enforcing regulations that protect the civil rights of Americans. It's created a gaping void that's required civil rights organizations like mine to step up and help fill the gap.
What's the history here? How has the Supreme Court ruled on disparate impact?
Well, this issue went before the Supreme Court a few years ago in a case called Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs versus Inclusive Communities Project. The court issued a 5-4 ruling that was authored by Justice Kennedy, where they held up the principle of disparate impact.
He, of course, has retired.
That's right.
And been replaced by Justice Kavanaugh. And so we'll see if this ends up in the courts, how it fares. That's Kristen Clark, President and Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. And we'll link you to the Washington Post reporting on the Trump administration considering a rollback of decades-old anti-discrimination laws called disparate impact. President Clark, Kristen, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
The trendy e-cigarette company Juul has been under scrutiny lately, facing lawsuits and threats from federal regulators because its products are so popular with teenagers. So the company is planning to launch a new TV ad campaign featuring adults who say Juul helped them quit smoking cigarettes.
It was really a friend of mine that said, "Why wouldn't you just try the Juul?" And I thought, okay, I'll try it. The idea of going back to smoking is, I couldn't even imagine doing that. I just don't enjoy it anymore.
Let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of the public radio podcast Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Jeremy.
So these ads are targeted at adults who want to quit smoking, and we're going to talk about the ads in a minute. But just set the scene for us first, because it may help us understand why Juul is spending so much money on this campaign. This company is dealing with a serious reputation issue because of its popularity among teenagers.
Yeah, and there's criticism coming in from all corners of public health advocacy. You're talking about PTAs, educators, clearly the FDA. I mean, just as the teen cigarette smoking rate was very nearly snuffed out a couple of years ago, here comes this snazzy device as if out of nowhere that's taking high schools by storm, and it's creating a fresh generation of nicotine addicts. And that's the problem with the Juul technology. It's so effective that it's now lorded over 70% market share. The question is, Jeremy, I mean, was popularity with teens purely unintended, or do you believe that Juul was happy all along to get those nicotine newcomers?
Mm-hmm. Well, what has Juul done since last fall when the FDA declared a teen vaping epidemic to curb teen use? Are they making real changes?
Well, they have agreed to pull certain products and snuff out social media marketing, which appeals disproportionately to people who were following. You know, you could go on YouTube, on Instagram and Snapchat and actually find these Juul influencers, believe it or not, walking you through this. Some people describing how you can exhale into your sleeve to avoid teachers, or there are even videos on kind of jury rigging a smoke detector or avoiding the smoke detector in the bathroom. It's really taken high schools by storm. And they've tried to show, good faith in dealing with the FDA that put it in its crosshairs, coming in and saying, actually, we're not trying to market to minors.
Okay, let's get back to these new ads. Here's another one. This one features a 47-year-old man who says using Juul helped him quit smoking after 34 years.
The switch was easy. But now that I look at people who smoke, I'm like, dude, really? You still doing that? You know, there's an alternative to that, right? You don't have to do that.
Is there any evidence, Robin, that Juul actually helps people quit smoking?
I've seen so much anecdotal evidence of people pulling me aside. I mean, for starters, you could look at the market share going from nowhere a couple of years ago to 70% and a company being valued at nothing to now $38 billion. There must be some underlying strength in that. And there was a great New Yorker article that the writer said when she took her first hit of the Juul, it's like the nicotine hit to the back of your head. You're effectively freebasing this stuff and you're giving up the tar and the arsenic and the various other components in the combustible product, but in exchange, you're becoming a nicotine junkie. So it does work in that you want to get people off the carcinogenic product, but then you build on this whole other layer of codependency that could be even harder to get off of.
Mm-hmm. So they're spending $10 million airing these ads on cable TV after 10 p.m. Is that going to work to change the company's image?
It's actually a small spend in the grand scheme of television, which in any case, teens and 20-somethings, you know, they don't much watch. But it's both the best and the worst times right now if you're Juul. Yes, they're flush with cash and market share, and they're now valued at $38 billion. But the brand is right in the crosshairs of the FDA and public advocates. And it's trying to buy time and incremental goodwill as it grows so massively.
And it is also potentially trying to convince regulators that it is separate from Big Tobacco, even though just a month ago, Juul got nearly $13 billion in financing with the cigarette giant Altria.
It's really one of the more fascinating headlines to my mind right now, both in business and in health news. You take a record investment from the country's biggest cigarette maker, the maker of Marlboros. Does Big Tobacco then want you to cannibalize its main moneymaker? If so, is it content to have you switch just current adult smokers? Or having shelled out $13 billion, would it also like to see you win fresh, i.e. younger converts to nicotine? And they're very politically and legally backed if you look at Philip Morris, its parent is Altria. But I wonder how the FDA and even the newly Democratic House will ultimately gavel down on this. It's certainly in the news every day.
One more thing I want to ask you about, Robin, since this is our business segment today. Macy's stock plunged 19% this morning after the department store chain reported weak holiday sales and slashed its profit outlook for the year. Does that come as a surprise?
You know, there were Christmas hopes that we had seen the worst and the last of this retail apocalypse. Yes, Amazon was going to Amazon, but Sears was going under, and these niche chains were getting their groove back and getting shoppers to come back in. But I think the bad news out of retail you're seeing today on Wall Street, it underscores how this is an ongoing, wrenching disruption. It's going to happen in fits and starts. You'll see stores close, mergers, bankruptcies, liquidations, new and old beneficiaries. And if this landscape is giving Walmart nightmares, remember when Walmart ruled the retail world?
Right. And I'm sure it's, I don't know how somebody like Jeff Bezos feels about it over at Amazon, but he's probably,
well, he's having a bad week.
He's having, he's getting divorced. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, thank you.
My pleasure, always.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.